Whole Life Carbon Assessment. Welcome to Construction and the Climate. This is a podcast series from 39 Essex Chambers with me, Camilla Tahar, and Ruth Keating.
In this podcast series, we'll be discussing the big climate issues affecting the construction sector.
We are joined this morning by Simon Sturgis. Simon is widely recognised as an expert, an innovator, and a lateral thinker in delivering a low-carbon, resource-efficient built environment. He's a lead UK thinker and has produced industry guidance for RICS, REBA, UK Green Building Council, BCO and others, which has already changed the way projects are designed and built in the UK. So welcome, Simon.
Thank you.
Simon, really good to have you on. You are, of course, the lead author of the first edition of the RICS Whole Life Carbon Assessment Standard. And it would be great if you could tell our listeners a little bit about what the aim of that standard was.
Yes, well, it came out in 2017, but we actually started working on it in about 2015, I think. And it came from an idea in my then office, and we were doing sustainability, if you like, but also we were experimenting with carbon calculation. And I wouldn't claim that we were the only people on the planet doing that, but we were certainly, I think, unusual, certainly in the UK. And we had developed a way of doing carbon calculations for various clients. And then the opportunity for funding. So there was the government funding, Innovate UK funding round, and we submitted a proposal for that, and we got 251,000, which is an odd figure. I can't quite remember how that was worked out, but anyway, we got that. And we basically got a team of people together from around industry. And again, at the time, there were not many people who kind of really knew about whole life carbon, embodied carbon, and so on. But we got a collection together, and we also persuaded the RICS, who were initially probably a bit skeptical, but we persuaded them to, with some of the budget probably helped, we persuaded them to host a series of discussions, which we had. And then from that, we wrote the document. And this was largely written by somebody who's working for me, Athena Papacosta. And she now has actually helped with the second edition, which we'll no doubt come on to. But the first edition, she wrote a lot of that, and with me sort of peering over her shoulder and interfering and changing things and what have you. But that document was then sort of peer-reviewed and so on, and then published in early 2017. And I think it fulfilled a need at the time, because many people were starting to wrestle with the idea of carbon in construction. And what version one did was it provided a methodology. Again, it wasn't a methodology that we'd invented, because there was already a European standard, EN15978, which is also being updated at the moment. But the original EN15978 set out a kind of framework for doing carbon calculations, but it did not tell you actually how to do them. And it didn't also have any sort of detail about add this to that or anything. So we did the best we could, and it actually proved incredibly successful. And as a result of that document, that first edition, other documents started to pop up. So the RIBA produced a document, which in fact I wrote, but then people like ISTRAPD, the structural engineers, SIBC and others all produced documentation which fed off and added to what the version one document had done. But also it started to sort of spread out across industry. And indeed, that accumulated in the Parliament taking an interest. And a couple of years ago, the Environment Audit Select Committee decided to look at sort of the carbon cost of construction, as opposed to what everybody had been focusing on, which was energy use and the carbon cost of energy use. So I, in fact, applied for and got the job of being the special advisor to the EAC, the Environment Audit Select Committee. And that was fascinating, because I'd never been involved with sort of parliamentary activities before. But I met the chair, Philip Dunn, interviewed me, and was a really interesting, good person. And it was also interesting because the committee is made up of all parties. And actually, it was very interesting to see this operate, because they were totally non-partisan. They were all working together to, if you like, the common good, which I thought was great. And my job was to look at providing questions for the committee to consider. And it's worth noting that the committee had already received, I forget, sort of 700 submissions of evidence or something. I mean, a huge number of bits of evidence. And it's a question of sifting out people who could attend the committee as witnesses, as you see in Parliament in those committee rooms with green chairs and things, and also helping the committee with the questions and briefing the committee, and also then working with the civil servants who were working with the committee to help them write the report. And actually, I mean, I contributed by commentary rather than writing anything. I mean, there was a lady who's doing the writing who was incredibly good at picking up stuff that most architects probably took the rest of their lives to figure out. But anyway, she figured it out in no time at all and wrote a fantastic report, and I commented and it went round and round. So that was all very helpful. And what that did do is it started to bring into the civil service, because that report then goes to the civil servants. And unlike, for example, something like the Defence Committee, which only deals directly with the Ministry of Defence, the Environmental Audit Committee actually deals with most or several government departments, which is unusual. I think only the Public Accounts does the same sort of thing. So that was unusual, which meant that we had to get responses from DLAC and BEIS and various others. So it did actually start to kind of infiltrate the mentality of the civil service bureaucracy, if you like, that there was this issue in embodied low-life carbon, which was a great help. So I think one of the things about the version one was that it was based on relatively little information that was out there. I mean, we had information, a few others had information, but, you know, really you're talking handfuls of case studies that we could base the methodology on, which is kind of risky. But there was an inherent logic, and I think it's worth mentioning that my sustainability practice, we'd been out there promoting the idea of carbon assessment to a range of developers, financiers, and so on. And I think I felt reasonably confident, because had there been flaws in the thought process of what we were doing, I think we would have been found out. Some clever finance director would have said, well, this is all rubbish because of X, Y, and Z. But in fact, that didn't happen. And indeed, if anything, people were very supportive. So that sort of led, and we published version one, and as I say, it's led to various things.
Simon, what I think is really interesting there in terms of the narrative is that you started from a position where, you know, as you say, you mightn't have been the only person in the world working on this, but certainly there was a small number of people really working on this. And you have that political story where Parliament becomes interested in it and the general civil service become interested in it. But a fascinating part of that story, I think, is when you say that you were going out with developers and people involved in finance and speaking to them about these issues. How have you found the uptake to have been from the private sector to, let's say, the first edition?
Well, I think it's been pretty amazing. I think typically, though, it started, if you like, in a sort of London-centric way. And I think this has been done by the larger developers who, if you like, had the resources to experiment. So, for example, early work we were doing with people like Grosvenor, Landsec, and so on. And in fact, the fees that we were getting for some of the work we did for Landsec, you would never get today because we were doing it all, if you like, in inverted commas, manually. Whereas now you've got, I mean, we had a spreadsheet that we were using, but fundamentally we were doing the assessments and giving advice and so on. But now, because you've got a range of software tools that do the calculations, provided you put in information in an intelligent fashion, and we might come back to that, then you should get good answers. But version two, which you're probably going to come on to, does things rather differently. So, well, it's expanded, shall I say, on what version one does. But in terms of developers, I think what many developers, and again, some of the more enlightened developers, began to see was that ESG, as they call it, environment, social, governance, is something that their tenants and occupiers are becoming increasingly concerned and interested in. And so I suppose it's not necessarily that developers are worried about saving the planet, but what they are concerned about, obviously, is getting tenants in and being ahead of the curve. And there's nothing wrong with that. So I think they began to see that this was an additional selling point. And in fact, there was a very instructive conversation I had with the project manager of Land Securities, as it was then, now Landsec, who said to me, you can do what you like as long as you don't cost me any time or money. So I thought, well, fair enough, actually, because that is the world that they live in. And really, if we can't deal with that, then there's something wrong with what we're doing. Now, in practice, I think what has become more and more clear is that actually, because we're talking about resource efficiency, if anything, we are starting to find that the opportunity for reducing costs is there rather than increasing costs. At the moment, I hesitate to say that with full confidence because there's a lot of innovation going on which has to be paid for and so on. But I think generally speaking, because you're trying to do more with less, if you like, ultimately that will start to pan out. And there is quite a lot of work and articles and so on the whole idea of the fact that reducing embodied carbon reduces costs. And certainly carbon and costs seem to go up together. So possibly they should come down together. It's not unexpected.
It's interesting to hear, Simon, how the larger developers sort of took the role first in experimenting and also that developers found that ESG was something that their occupiers would be interested in. Have you found that the standard has moved things along in the industry in general?
Well, yes. I think, yeah, whether it's the standard or just the general mood music moving on and we're just part of it, I wouldn't comment. But I think that certainly now, I mean, if I go back, say, let's say 10 years, no developers had a sustainability person, or they might have had somebody tinkering around in the background. Now, sustainability is very much part and parcel of what your primary developers are interested in. I mentioned Landsec, Derwent and others all have people who are dedicated to this. And indeed, their project teams, when they employ people to do the work on a new or any project work, the sustainability thing is part and parcel. Now, how much that's actually influencing design decisions, I think, is evolving. I think also architects and engineers are clearly much more aware of these things, but I think are still not necessarily fully informed. And I think what we have to remember, I believe, is that, and actually if I can quote, my favorite quote is from Mark Carney when he was governor of the Bank of England. And he said, you can't get to net zero by flicking a green switch. You've got to rewire your entire economy. And I think it's that last sentence, rewire your entire economy, which suggests that this is not about tinkering around with BREEAM ratings or anything like that. This is pretty comprehensive. And I think it's that comprehensive nature of the change needed to get to net zero that is just gradually beginning to dawn on people that, you know, we can't carry on as before. And indeed, we are going to have to make changes. Now, I'm an architect, and I think as an architect, I think that's quite exciting. I think you have to go back to something like the 1920s to find when the modern movement happened. And obviously, as a consequence of the First World War, it was an answer to the problem of replacing vast amounts of buildings. And I think we now have another sort of existential crisis in the sense of the climate crisis. And I think, you know, if you take Mark Carney's words at face value, this means that radical surgery is required and right across the economy. And it's not just architects and buildings, it's everything. So I think that is an opportunity. And I think that's quite exciting for speaking as an architect, or I'm not an engineer, but I think people are starting to experiment with various things, but there are no panaceas. There's no easy, quick answer to all these issues. Some people say, oh, well, just build in wood. Well, no, that's not necessarily the answer, because if everybody built in wood, we'd cut down all our forests, and that would be a disaster. So you've got to get these things right. And I think certainly the first version didn't really comprehensively cover all this stuff, because it was the first time we'd done this in any sort of detail.
Simon, I think what also comes out from everything you've said is that it's a very complex area. It's also a movable feast in some sense, as all of our different elements of understanding develop. Looking at the RIC standard, are there any kind of notable differences between that approach versus international comparative standards that we have to look at?
Well, the answer is there shouldn't be, because three of the co-authors, including myself, Jane Anderson, and Athena Pepper-Costa, were all also involved with the update to EN 15978, which hasn't come out yet, and I think it might come out next year. But so as we were involved in both, what we were able to do was ensure that the kind of content or the principal issues emerging within the revised EN 15978, the European standard, were that we were able to align the RICS version 2 with that. So there shouldn't be any horrible surprises when EN 15978, the update, comes out. And that standard is obviously used across Europe, but it's also, I think, sort of recognized around the world. I mean, the Americans, they do things slightly differently, but I think they all are cognizant of EN1597. Certainly places like the Far East, Singapore, India, and so on, tend to use, I think, those sorts of things because they're there, they're available, and they work. And I think equally, RICS, the new standard that we've done, the version 2, one of the things we try to do is make that much more international. So, for example, we don't refer to RIBA project stages. There's a little table in there explaining what the stages mean, but we refer to sort of more generic stages, sort of concept design, technical design, and so on. And that was intentional to enable it to be used more globally. We do, in the new version 2, it's worth saying that version 2 is 200 pages long, whereas version 1 was about 40, so you can get some idea of how much more stuff there is in the new one. But version 2 does make reference to UK, for example, because it's UK-based, things like travel distances are UK-orientated or UK-oblique Europe-orientated. Obviously, if you're living in India or China or somewhere, then the distances may be significantly different, or if you're, you know, so on. But as a lot of trade in building materials is global, if you're buying granite for a facade or something of an office building, well, that can come from Italy, it could come from China, it could come from Scandinavia, wherever. So it has to be international. I think that, and I think the RICS is promoting it internationally at the moment. So it does try and fulfill that. And we do explain, if you're living in another country, what you should do by way of using different travel distance or whatever, or carbon factors or whatever it is.
It's interesting to hear that the second edition is now 200 pages, whereas the first edition was 40 pages. You've also explained that the second edition is a little more international, but could you explain how else the second edition builds on the first edition?
Yes. So there are a number of things that we decided to respond to. So the first edition was produced in 2017. Since then, in the UK, we've had government legislation in 2019, which was to get to net zero. And then in 2021, we had further legislation giving interim dates for, which is all on the same basic trajectory, but interim dates. Also, we had commitments at COP26 by the government. So all of those things have sort of steered things slightly differently or given a bit of focus to it all. So that was one thing. The other thing was that, as I might have mentioned, that the version one, the data that we had was really based only on a few office projects, I think, and maybe might have been one residential or two, but basically it was very limited. Now, there's a lot more information out there. So we were able to not only cover all building types, but what we were also keen to do was cover infrastructure. And by infrastructure, I mean both things like airports and motorways and ports and things, but also urban infrastructure. So if you're doing a housing scheme or a mixed-use scheme of some sort, then you would not just do the buildings, but you'd also do the road system and the drainage and everything else. So what we've done is, and if there was a railway going through the middle of it or a tube line with a tube station, you could include all that. So the point being that it was very much broadening the whole thing. Secondly, we tried to make it much more accessible and readable. And indeed, if you read, I think it's chapters 1, 2, and 3 are relatively short and are not, if you like, aimed at geeks. They are, I think anybody would understand those. I think when you get further into the document, it gets much more specifically technical, if you like. And although we've tried to make it accessible, and we've used a lot more diagrams and all that kind of thing, what we've tried to do is, so there's all that sort of accessibility and so on. We've also covered, and I mentioned to cover different building types, but what we've also done is we've covered things like refurbishment, retrofit, and for offices or indeed residential fit out. So if you provide a shell and core building and then somebody else does the fit out, you can work out how to do all of that. A couple of other key things which I think were really important. One was that we wanted to introduce a contingency or a risk factor. So if you're doing a cost plan on a project, working out how much it's going to cost to build it, you will work it out and then you'll add, at the early stages of a project, you'll add 10% or 15% or whatever it is. And as you get closer to it being finished, that percentage will drop. So we've introduced a contingency figure, which is made up of three components. And those three components are the project stage. So you start off with a base figure, which is higher if you're early project stage and lower if you're nearly practical completion. But also we've got two other figures that get added to that. One is to do with the reliability of carbon data, whether you've got good or bad carbon data, and secondly, whether you've got good or bad quantities data. And although that may seem a little complicated, we've done it like that because it helps people really understand the components that go into a calculation, and therefore you sort of know what you need to get better at, if you like, or find out. So that was one thing. The other thing that we also have done, and this was particularly two key authors, Clara Bagnall-George, who also sort of runs Leti, and her colleague Louise Amo. Now, they had written guidance for SIBSE, particularly TM65, which is to do with embodied carbon in plant and equipment and stuff like that. And what they've done with this, and I was very keen that we should try and do this, is up until this point, you calculated energy use in kilowatt hours, and you calculated the carbon impacts of bricks and mortar and stuff as kilograms of CO2. And neither the twain shall meet, because you can't add kilowatt hours to kilograms of CO2. So what Clara and Louise did was come up with a methodology for converting kilowatt hours into carbon emissions. Now, being an architect, I thought, what's all the fuss about that? It's surely a straightforward activity. But in fact, it is quite complex, and they've done a really great job in simplifying that so that it is, and there are various sets. So depending on where you are on a project, you use a slightly different approach. But the important point is that the net zero that government has legislated on is net zero carbon. It's not net zero energy. And there is a difference. And so it seemed to us that to have embodied carbon, i.e. the carbon emissions from materials or associated with creating materials, and the operational carbon, i.e. the energy use emissions, that they should be on the same footing. Now, the importance of that is that, for example, use a simple example, if you are trying to decide how much insulation to use, clearly the more insulation you put in, the higher the embodied cost is, but the less energy you use, i.e. the lower amount of carbon emissions get expended in using that building. So you need to know the correlation between how much you put in and what you get out for it. It's cost-benefit, quite simple cost-benefit analysis. So that was pretty critical. And also it relates to things like time, so, you know, replacement cycles and all the rest of it. So it was very important to have this unified methodology. There's just a lot more information. I think it's just clearly with that. I mean, the original document version one, I think the services or the energy use section, I think it was about a page and a half or maybe two pages, and it's now about 40 or 50 pages. I can't remember exactly. But so there's been a massive increase in that. And I think the new document is much more robust. I mean, we issued a draft in early 2023, and I think about February 2023, a draft was published, and we expected to get about 200 or 300 responses. In fact, we got about 1,500 responses from across industry and from people globally. And those responses, they were collated by Sarah Crouch at the RICS, and she did a great job in sorting all that out. What became apparent is they tend to drop into certain categories, and we were able to examine all of those and make sure that we were lining up with that. So actually, that was fantastic feedback, and it meant that the thing really did work quite well. So that eventually we led to the document being published in September 23, but an update was issued in November, which corrected various sort of odds and ends which needed to be corrected. And I think we're still collecting a few bits and pieces. I mean, there are, so for example, we just had some people from Cambridge University asking some questions, people who I knew, and we were able to answer them without saying we've made a mistake. Like, so it's quite important, I think, to help people who are either doing research or using them in anger. I think the other thing we recognized was that, in fact, although the document's out there, most people will not read it who are using it, if you like, by default. And the reason is that most people who do use carbon accounting will use a software tool either created in-house, and a number of companies, whether they're quantity surveyors or architects or people like Turner & Townsend, have got their own in-house created software tools, which I'm imagining are just fancy spreadsheets. or they've bought a commercially available tool. Now, one of the things that we are trying to sort out is to ensure that software providers, if they are selling their product in this country, that they align with the RICS standard, the latest version, because the previous version, one they claimed to align with, but I think it wasn't entirely true, if I put it gently. So I think it's very important that they do. And I think also what's quite important is that people use the standard with intelligence. So instead of just plugging numbers into the software tool and expecting an automatically perfect answer, you've got to understand the nature of what you're doing. Otherwise, you could be getting it badly wrong. And I think this is still an evolving area. And I think, although I feel pretty confident that the content in the RICS version 2, and I can assure you I'm not going to be doing RICS version 3. RICS version 2, as I say, I'm very confident in what it's doing. I think we have to recognize that things are evolving and changing, and with more knowledge comes more understanding and so on. And I'm sure that version 3 in maybe 5 years' time will be different again, hopefully shorter this time.
Thank you so much, Simon. That's such a detailed overview. And it's interesting that you say that it's important that the users understand it, but also that the software sort of aligns with it. Following on from that, how would you say that the standards fit in with ensuring lines of responsibility along the supply chain?
That's an interesting question. I think that the issue of responsibility, I mean, my feeling is that it needs to be with the designers. By that, I mean the architects and engineers and so on. And I would also include with that product designers. And I think what is happening in terms of the supply chain at the moment is that because people who make products are aware of all of this, they are, the whole life carbon assessment, so they are aware that they need to meet the criteria, i.e. that they are able to supply products that will be able to be assessed as low carbon. And to do that, they have to, first of all, produce an environmental product declaration or EPD. So that is a cost. But again, coming back to the sort of idea of the enlightened developer, is that if you go to that idea, a number of these developers are prioritizing the use of products which have EPDs. So they will only go to something that doesn't have an EPD if they can't find one with that suits their purposes. And I think that's quite an important thing, because that does put pressure on the supply chain. It also puts pressure on consultants. And I know that certain of the bigger developers, again, the sort of Landsec of British Lands and Grosvenor of this world, who are doing these assessments as a matter of course, they are requiring, first of all, their design teams to understand how this all works, but also they are aggregating all these assessments across their portfolios so that they can get a portfolio-wide understanding of what they're doing. And this will feed into things like science-based targets and the like. And I think it's also now realized that this is not a whole extra cost. And I think one of the questions that I keep being asked when I have done sort of presentations and had discussions with people like DLUHC is, what does this all cost the user? Well, you can get a free download from Field & Clegg Bradley Studios' website of a spreadsheet. It's a sort of sophisticated spreadsheet which will help you do carbon assessments. And that's a free download, so you can do that. And the amount of time when you've sort of got the understanding of how to do it, if you're working on a project of any sort of even modest size, say it's a few days or a week or so at most. So it's that kind of scale of expense or time involvement. Now, if you can't claim that back from the client as an extra cost, well, nevertheless, it enhances your offer as a consultant. And I think even if you're just doing very simple little assessments just to get a feel for, is it better to use a steel frame or a concrete frame or a timber frame? What is the pluses and minuses of those things? Well, you can work that out. And I think if you get past all the numbers, one thing I think I'm very keen on is the idea that architects and engineers build up, particularly architects, build up and up the idea of a carbon intuition, so that you don't have to do the sums every time you do something, but you begin to develop the knowledge that, yes, timber might be better in this case, but if we go too far, we create problems or whatever it is. So I think, again, it comes back to the idea of, and that understanding will come with a bit of practice. But I think at heart, this is not, and I know you used the word complex earlier on in this discussion, I don't think that the actual processes are complex. Ultimately, it's about an efficient use of resources. And that covers not just the assembly of resources into a building, but also the longevity of that. Because obviously, if you're having to replace things all the time, well, that's not an efficient use of resources. So it's not always the case to say, well, if you use something lightweight green material on day one, that's going to be brilliant forever. Well, it may not. For example, people are now rediscovering how to use stone, and stone, which requires cutting and all sorts of things, which is quite a carbon-intensive activity. Nevertheless, people are now realizing that actually, with clever use of stone, it can actually be, in inverted commas, a low-carbon product if used intelligently and correctly. So I think the whole thing about the supply chain and examining all these things is it's giving people the idea to rethink how you use these things. So that comes back to what I was saying earlier about opportunity, and that it's an exciting time, I think, for designers, because you can start to think about how these things can work better.
Simon, I think that Mark Carney quote that you used really does encapsulate much of the topic, that you can't get to net zero by flicking a green switch. You have to rewire the entire economy. And I think it also really captures what you were saying in terms of this comprehensive change is needed in the face of what is no doubt an existential crisis in terms of the climate. But it's also an opportunity. And I think myself and Camilla really like when we talk to people on the podcast, they recognize that. And as we develop, we'll have to coin it, Simon, your term, the carbon intuition. Over time, as we become more familiar with this, there really is an opportunity here as well as a challenge. And I think our listeners will really enjoy hearing that. So thank you, Simon. You have a wealth of knowledge. We've really had to fight with your diary to get you on the podcast. So we're so delighted we finally got to speak with such a busy person. And thank you to our listeners for listening as well.
At 13 Essex Chambers, we cover a vast array of practice areas and sectors. You can find out more about our expertise and our barristers at 39essex.com, where you can also see our extensive catalogue of articles, podcasts, and webinars.